The Guardian.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook if you sign up for a 2-week trial of their service. Audible has 40,000 titles available to download. For all the details, follow the links at guardian.co.uk/audible.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Claire Armistead.
Welcome to the Guardian Books Podcast. It's been a newsy week in the world of literature with the announcement of the Costa shortlists on Tuesday, quickly followed by the American National Book Awards. We have 2 signed copies of Patti Smith's NBA-winning memoir Just Kids to give away. But you'll have to wait to the end of this podcast to find out how to win them, because first we're heading out into the real world, and in particular to the treacherous borderland between the US and Mexico, where the news is far from good. A group of terrified schoolchildren are shepherded away from a gunfight between soldiers and drug gangsters. This is the sort of fearful experience ordinary people in northern Mexico, just south of the US border, are living through every day. We'll be talking to the author of a new book about a situation that appears to be getting grimmer all the time. But we'll also hear about the success stories of Latin America from a Colombian writer who looks at what will happen when Latinos rule the world. And we'll be meeting the 4th of our shortlisted authors for the Guardian First Book Award, a young American, Miley Chapman, who set her first novel in a Finnish convalescent hospital in the 1920s.
Actually, my birthday, the year that I was in Finland, I wanted to go to this particular hospital. It's called the Children's Castle. It's a pediatric hospital from the 40s. Mm. It sounds like a weird way to spend your birthday, but that's what I wanted to do. But that was at the time, it sounded great.
Miley Chapman talking about her novel, Your Presence is Requested in Cervanto. But first, to Mexico, by foreign correspondent Ed Vulliami. It's subtitled War Along the Borderline and deals with the uncontrollable violence along the US-Mexican border. Welcome, Ed.
Thank you.
Here's a brief sample of the stream of reports from the area.
60,000 Mexican military and police are fighting against the 5 major drug cartels, which control lucrative smuggling routes into the U.S.
Mexican investigators now believe members of 2 powerful drug organizations confronted each other with high-caliber weapons early Friday, leaving at least 21 gunmen killed and 9 wounded.
These are some of the smaller of the 12 million or so items seized from Mexico's drugs cartels, and they're up for grabs at auction. They include wristwatches valued at a whopping $300,000 each, and diamond rings on which bidding will only start at around $114,000. Auction organizers...
What happened inside that cement building on the right has horrified all of Mexico.
Just 2 days earlier, police paraded the building's owner, 45-year-old Santiago Lopez, before the media. They say he used this hideaway to destroy the remains of hundreds of murder victims, cooking them in barrels of acid.
It's the largest caliber weapon you can legally buy. A 50 caliber, shooting palm-sized bullets that can blast through car doors and bulletproof vests in one deadly pull of a trigger.
And those 50 caliber guns are showing up on the streets of Juarez, Mexico, like this street, Gatzamala, next to a daycare center where a commander of the police department, coming out of his home and getting in his car, was gunned down right here.
They're terrorizing the country with very public acts of violence. In December, this group of Mexican soldiers was found with their heads cut off, and a note from traffickers warning, "For every one of mine you kill, we will kill 10.
Troubling stuff, but it isn't the Latin America our next guest likes to dwell on. He's Oscar Guardiola Rivera, Colombian academic based in London University's Birkbeck College. And he sets out a radical story with the title of his book, What If Latin America Ruled the World? How the South Will Take the North into the 22nd Century. Now, I'll give you 2 boys a chance to slug it out later, but for listeners who are not yet familiar with the books, I'd like you both to give a little précis of your books. Ed, can you just start?
Claire, thank you very much. As a book, it's a journey along a border
borderland, the busiest borderland in the world, between Mexico and the United States, which is almost charged in itself. And during my time working down there, it became a book about a war along that borderline. A million people traverse it every day to go to school, shop.
2,100
miles. It is a line in the sand. Needs must, the Americans say. It is a fence, literally, 700 miles of it. Was it going to be a virtual fence until President Obama realized that was a rotten idea? It is also the busiest commercial border in the world in terms of trade that crosses it, and a million people cross it every day to go shopping, visit relatives, attend school, indeed, or have a meal. And along this borderline, for reasons that are in many ways endemic to it and to the two countries, it is now a place that is the kernel of a war in which 28 to 30,000 people have died in the last few years.
Now, Ed, would you be hugely insulted if I were to describe you as a gonzo journalist?
Yes.
Because you're going to very dangerous places, you're reporting them, you're watching, you're seeing the violence, you're meeting these people. It's a very different sort of book to Oscars, which is a sort of considered history. But I have to give you the right of reply.
I write about war, I write about violence, because I hate them.
Okay, we'll hold that thought there.
I get scared.
Yeah,
I get very scared, absolutely. Which gonzo journalists aren't supposed to.
Oscar, explain a little bit about your book.
Well, I suppose I am a gonzo writer just because I've lived in Colombia. The book is about the long history that explains precisely all these things, but also all the success stories that we're witnessing in Latin America right now. So the book is part travelogue, part history, part imagination of a future that has now arrived in Latin America.
Your title is What If, but your subtitle is When. And you say when the South rules the North. So what exactly do you mean by South? Do you mean Latin America?
What I mean by South is the way in which countries like Brazil, for instance, in Latin America, are creating new alliances with countries like India or with South Africa and or Turkey or Iran. And those alliances are already being very effective insofar as potential changes in international relations go.
There are some quite startling statistics, aren't there? You say by 2014, Brazil will be the world's fifth largest economy, which is overtaking France and Britain.
Either the fifth or the fourth. And this leads us to the second big thesis of the book, which is the following one. The combined weight of both continents of the Americas, the United States, and led by the United States and Brazil, will give any wannabe hegemon a run for its money.
Yeah.
And while everybody else is telling us to look at China, how China is going to replace a declining West, I'm telling everyone, look, let's not be declinist. In fact, the United States has no real rivals. What is most interesting is the internal story, how the United States is changing vis-a-vis Latin America.
Yeah. Now, another statistic you have is that by 2040, the U.S. will have a Latino majority. Is that something that strikes terror into your heart, Ed?
No, although I think the point about Mexico, if we're going to talk about this place, is it is the penumbra between the world that Oscar is talking about and that which the United States regards as its problem that's, you know, rather like the future coming across the borderline into America, not just demographically, but in terms of so many other things. It is a book about a drug war. And it is a book about the ferocity and the savagery that we heard about in the news bulletins. That's unavoidable. It is about the United States' insatiable appetite for getting high. That's how it all started. You know, as a book, it's a rollick along. It's faces and places. It's rock and roll. Because this country, and this is what drew me there in the first place, it's a place of bright, bright colors and occult shadows.
In fact, what we're witnessing in Mexico produces, as Colombians, an inevitable sense of deja vu. We have seen it all before. This is history repeating. This is exactly what was happening in Colombia in the 1980s. And the danger now is that something like what happened in Colombia in the last decade can also happen both in Mexico and in the United States, which is that after drug traffickers, then they start a stealth campaign to use their money in order to gain political power. That happened in Colombia, and it would be very dangerous, but it is very likely that that will also happen in the U.S.-Mexican border. In fact, it has already happened. In the 1970s and 80s, they also used their money in order to fund political campaigns. The Republican Party received money and so on and so forth. And the problem with this is that this is a business.
Yes. The narco cartel is not a pastiche of global capitalism. They are pioneers of it. These cartels were NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, long before NAFTA.
Absolutely.
And it is crucial, I think, to see what they're doing as a sideshow of what is happening within the quote-unquote legal economy. On the other hand, I think the point is cultural as well. There are big differences between the new wave of Mexican cartels and the old Colombian Medellin and Cali syndicates. Take the Zetas, the military wing of the Gulf cartel. This is an army. This is a paramilitary army. Yes, there were narco armies in Colombia. But this is very much violence of the digital, post-modern, post-ideological, I think post-moral age. It's the age of greed. This is the language of greed. It's a utterly belligerent materialist war about social kudos. It's on YouTube. It's digital. And the other thing, crucially, that's very different from Colombia, whereas what Oscar is writing about is the industrialization, in defiance of the United States, of Latin America very successfully, and interesting political experiments with Evo Morales and so on. Whereas what I'm writing about really is the result of the deindustrialization of areas that were dependent on the United States. If I can just explain very, very quickly, what happened along the border was a great big necklace, a long necklace of bonded duty-free factories was assembled, to which people flocked, not to cross the border, but to work alongside it for wages that were appalling by US standards. It was like having the third world on their doorstep, but quite good by the Mexican interior. When those factories start, you know, buggering off to Asia, excuse me, they leave behind, if you treat people like trash, they leave behind what I call, a pastor instituted Juarez, the most dangerous city in the world, called the human junkyard. So in a way, what I'm trying to write about is the cautionary tale about deindustrialization of a Mexican world that's subordinate to the United States, whereas what Oscar's writing about is the emergence of an industrial continent in defiance of the United
States.
Now,
I'd like to hear a little bit from Oscar about the good side of what's going on in Latin America. Some of the collectives, there's really interesting stuff happening there, isn't there?
Absolutely. But let me first react to what Ed just said. Ed makes a very good point. Of course, the point of comparison is not between Mexico in the 21st century and Colombia in the 1980s, but rather with the way in which Colombian cartels also mutated. Colombian cartels became the paramilitary irregular army, which started fighting the left-wing guerrillas alongside the regular army and became part of the state in the last decade. They also learned the lessons from the North. They became better at presenting themselves as businessmen. And what happened in Mexico and what happened after NAFTA fails, all this was a hard lesson for Latin America. The deindustrialization that was the final result of these so-called free trade agreements was exactly the wrong model. And this is when Latin American countries, Venezuela, Bolivia, also southeastern Colombia, Peru, Argentina, Chile, start recovering the memory of the experiments that they tried out in the 1970s, which were interrupted. And once they do that and start putting them in practice, we have success stories and pioneering schemes, the most important one of them being the conditional cash transfer programs, which were pioneered by Bolivia and Brazil, which actually allowed Brazil to have the sort of aggregate demand that countered the bad effects of the 2008 recession. So to put it in very simple terms, Latin American countries decided to bail out the people rather than bailing out just the banks. As a result of that, there was neither the huge sovereign debt that we see in the developed world, but also some very interesting examples.
Chavez deciding in Venezuela, deciding to leave 20% of the oil in the ground rather than...
You have radical ideas such as that one, which in the mind of some very important scientists working on global warming will be the only practical solution to climate change. And you also have other very interesting experiments, such as the way in which Bolivia is trying to industrialize vis-a-vis a potential future for the electric car industry. People don't know this, but Bolivia has some of the biggest reserves of lithium in the world. So if actually the electric car revolution takes off, Bolivia might become the next Saudi Arabia.
We're agreed, aren't we, about the sort of the corruption of the West and also a historical inequality which has created a lot of these situations. I mean, both of you go into the history, the colonial history of these regions, don't you?
Well, absolutely. In fact, there is a chapter in my book in which I move from the story of a financier named William Paterson in the 19th century and the, you know, the chain of financial scandals and Ponzi schemes that we witnessed between the United States and the Caribbean in the previous 2 years. And in fact, this is the intention of this chapter, is to make a direct connection between precisely the sort of wars, these banal wars, which are capitalistic wars that are about acquiring money and bling, and what is happening with the financial system. Everybody knows that the cartels, both the Colombians and the Mexicans, they profit and use the shadowy banking system that exists in the Caribbean, in Panama, but also in Texas. People like Allen Stanford, for instance, who was captured by the FBI doing one of these Ponzi schemes, well, it was found that he was laundering drugs money. This is the way in which the market has always worked.
Well, this is clearly a discussion that's going to run and run. And I just want to leave with actually a little anecdote from Ed's book, which is that in 2006, salsa, that's salsa the sauce, not salsa the dance, overtook ketchup as the US's favourite condiment. So the influence is not just drugs money, it is also about taste, isn't
Absolutely
it, and
not.
Fashion. Thank you very much, Oscar Guardiola Rivera and Ed Vulliamy. What If Latin America Ruled the World is published by Bloomsbury, and A Mexica is just out from Bodley Head. With so much drama going on the doorstep, it seems extraordinary that any American novelist should need to look abroad for material. But that's just what the fourth of our shortlistees for the Guardian First Book Award has done. She is Miley Chapman, and our columnist Hadley Freeman went to meet her at her apartment in New York. Her novel is called Your Presence is Requested at Savanto, and going by L.P. Hartley's edict, The Past is a Foreign Country, They Do Things Differently There, it is doubly foreign. It takes place in Finland in the 1920s. Hadley asked Miley first what drew her to this particular setting.
Whenever I've tried to describe it, it sounds like such a bunch of disparate things coming together, the hospital and the nursing go together, but then Finland, and people often say, well, why Finland? Why did you set it in Finland? And I had a grant to go there, and people said, well, why are you going there in particular to write a novel? Mm. And a lot of it was because I like looking through old architecture books. And I saw a picture of this particular hospital, and it stuck with me. And I looked up other pictures of it, and it was just such an amazing building. It looked like it was built in 1979 or something, mm-hmm. and it was designed in 1929, I think, construction started. And I thought, that's amazing, because it was a curvy look, and there were kind of, you know, red details and a yellow floor. Mm-hmm. It was so 70s that I just couldn't believe it. And the more I read about it, the more I loved it. And so that hospital was the first inspiration.
And also, you talk in the book, and I mean, I've heard this before, that Finnish is the hardest language to learn. And that kind of adds to the sense of dislocation. And it was that another issue in it, the various language barriers between the Finnish speakers and the Swedish speakers, and then Sunny, the American nurse.
Yes. Yes to it being a very difficult language to learn. Yes to it being kind of a barrier. And when I went, I was really lucky. I had this great grant, I had a Fulbright grant, and the people at the Fulbright Center were just wonderful. The people at the university that I chose let me basically take any class that I wanted, and I studied Finnish.
Wow, so how is your Finnish?
It is not good. it is, but I love it. I can read a little more than I can speak.
Wow.
I'm daunted by the pronunciation, but it's a beautiful language, and I love the way that it sounds. And I had a lot of interactions with people in Finnish because I was going out to look at buildings and encountering people who didn't always speak English. And actually, my birthday, the year that I was in Finland, I wanted to go to this particular hospital. It's called the Children's Castle. It's a pediatric hospital from the 40s. Mm. It sounds like a weird way to spend your birthday, but that's what I wanted to do. But that was at the time, it sounded great. And when I got there, my English-speaking guide had been pulled away for some reason. But one of the facilities engineers took it upon himself to show me every inch of the building, probably much more than I would have seen on any other tour. He showed me the boiler rooms. He took me to the attic. He showed me things that I'm not even sure what I was seeing, because he only spoke Finnish. The main character, in many ways, is the American head nurse, and her name is Sunny. And the book follows Sunny throughout the course of a year, and she deals with a lot of the things that a foreigner deals with when they're relocating and living and working and trying to immerse in a new place. She spends a lot of time on her own because she's in this peculiar place between the patients and the staff where she's sort of the mediator between them, and she knows them personally, but she's also taking care of them, so she's not their friend. She spends a lot of time by herself. She has problems with insomnia, as many people do who don't grow up in the north, and then they go, and the shorter hours of daylight are hard to adjust to. So in this passage, she's been given a message in the middle of the night that Julia, one of the older characters who's a troublemaker, is not in her bed, and no one knows where she is, and Sunny goes out looking for her in the corridors. She begins at the top of the building. The solarium is dark. She touches the switch by the door. The wall of black glass, with nothing to see outside in the darkness, gives it the feeling of a nighttime observation deck on an overnight ferry, looking out over limitlessly cold, deep water. There's a chill despite the heaters. All of the gleaming surfaces, the red floor, the wood-framed chairs, encourage an upright posture easier to hold in sunlight while writing letters, for example, while playing cards. It is the wrong room for right now, and she draws the accordion door shut. The way to the promenade is locked. The railings there are disarmingly low, and even during her time here, some have been tempted to let themselves step over, falling into the night. Only half of them have survived the fall. She shakes the padlock, inviolate, down to the dining room. The night lights are on, but she touches the wall switch to be sure the room is empty, and it is, all quiet, with the table set already for breakfast, with folded napkins and small juice glasses upended to avoid any minute accumulation of overnight dust.
I think what a lot of people say about the book, what I certainly found, is just the tone of it, the way it really captures that sort of really dozy, institutionalized life, where you're sort of in this building and days sort of drift away.
I hadn't actually thought of this until you said that, but that's kind of like a writing day at home. I've always sort of liked that kind of lulling routine, especially in winter.
Mm-hmm.
It just is cozy and it sort of carries you through. And I was living in Syracuse, New York when I started writing this.
Mm.
And I started writing it in January, and it was really, really snowy.
And how long did it take you to write?
I actually started writing it in 2001. I started mm-hmm. making notes for it.
Mm-hmm.
And some of that was because I was finishing an MFA and I had been writing short stories. And I knew that this kind of postgraduate school slump was coming, where you finish your thesis and then, you know, you no longer get to say, you know, hello, I'm a fiction writer, because that's your role in the program. You know, when that's gone and your project is finished, there's this lag time.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, no, I'm going to start working on a novel, and it's going to be something really complex, and it'll keep me busy for a good long while.
Mm-hmm.
And then it did. So, yeah, 8 or 9 years.
And so what were you doing as well as doing that? Or was that your main focus because you had the scholarship grants and stuff like that?
No, I did a lot of other things mm-hmm. in between. Yeah,
you did a lot of writing for the magazines, I've seen.
Yes, mm-hmm. literary journals and, mm-hmm. and things like that, and short stories. And so I was writing those throughout while working on this. And then in the last year or two, I was pushing on the novel, and I kind of fell behind on the short stories. It's a form that I also like. So.
Really? So that's your next plan, do you reckon?
Maybe. I'm working on another novel at the moment. Which is I have a grant at the New York Public Library to do research.
Oh right, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I'm researching that all the time, and it's really great to have a year to just devote to that. But in the time that I was working on this, I was lucky. I got to spend 5 years in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
I was in Finland. I was in Northern Germany, and I was in Ireland.
Cold Northern European countries.
That seems to be the pattern.
So are you able to say the kind of thing you're working on now, or it's still in the development stage?
It's another one of those things that sounds like a big hot mess of things being drawn together, and that's part of why I'm so grateful to have access to all of the collections at the library, because I can look at things. In many ways, it's about Alzheimer's, and it's about adult children figuring out how to care for
mm-hmm.
their parents. It's a devastating thing, and so
when
many
parents become children, basically.
Yeah. And it doesn't end. It's progressive, and it's wrenching,
mm.
and so many people that I've mentioned it to have some family connection to it, almost everybody. But it's also about sort of uneasiness and fear around illness, and about,
which is in this book too, a little
yeah.
bit. And the illnesses that Miley describes in this book are, for readers out there, incredibly devastating and very difficult, particularly in the 1920s. It's a lot about women's illnesses, to use a slightly euphemistic term there,
mm-hmm.
which is painful to read. It must have been incredibly painful to research and to write about as well.
I've had an interest in medicine forever, pretty much. And there have been times in the research of that book, and also in the research I'm doing now, where I have to set it aside and read something else for a while, because mm-hmm. it is upsetting. Mm-hmm. And for me to think about people in previous times dealing with the sorts of illnesses that they had, that I was just reading just this last week about some of the problems people had coming through Ellis Island, and things that now, literally 5 days of antibiotics, but at the time, a rash would get you sent back, and there's your life savings spent on the passage over, and there's the rest of your family going through, and there's you being put back on the boat and sent back, and that's your life. So much easier to take care of now. I just feel really humbled when I think about how people have lived with pain and discomfort for so long.
And shame.
And shame.
Yeah.
Her cork heels make no sound on the rubber flooring. She casts no shadow on the walls. And then, to the left, the door of the radiant room is standing open. She pushes aside the draft curtain. The lights inside are dim, as elsewhere, and the fireplace is lit and glowing. There is a slow, uncurling movement on one of the couches. Julia, alone, is leaning back against the cushions, with her hair down and her dark fur coat tucked around her shoulders. She blinks, and in the firelight, her pupils are green and glassy, her face smoothed by shadows. She's been blamelessly asleep, with her nightgown pulled up to expose her bare legs to the warmth. She moves her legs out of the way, and for a time Sunny sits down on the couch beside her. But there's a record turning on the phonograph, a violin and a voice, both terribly sad. A song in Finnish, again. Sunny catches a few of the words when they are drawn out enough. Full moon, love, how very much. Julia slides off the sofa and stands with one dry hand extended. I'll teach you how to dance to this one, she says. I can't dance, says Sunny. I know, I said I'll teach you. And Julia waits, hand extended, and then her hand twitches with uncertainty. Then it is only to prove to Julia that her flesh is not poisonous, that Sunny stands, much taller, and accepts her hand. And now, newly, Sunny looks and she sees Julia, sees the darkness of her eyes and her nostrils, and understands with a little sadness that she must have once been a warm brunette, a peachy Danish beauty. And the eyes that look back from behind Julia's face are not the eyes of an old person, just eyes, and ageless.
Were there any books that you got inspiration from for this one?
I read The Magic Mountain.
Yeah, I was going to ask, because that, in terms of sort of sanatorium stuck away somewhere, that's what it really made me think of as well.
Yeah. I loved that book, and I loved how long it took me to read that book. And I also, there's a book called Ava by an American writer named Carol Maso that very, you know, I keep referencing it, and I'm not sure people have read it. It's so beautiful, AVA, and it's a woman's thoughts pretty much on the last day of her life, when she's in her hospital bed and in a state of delirium, and all of the people who mattered to her and the places that she's been sort of come together in this really wow. beautiful, very beautiful way. It's unlike any other book that I've ever read.
Do you find it hard to sort of slough off the characters afterwards, because we're so immersed in their minds, you know, even like Mrs. Minder, but also like Sunny, and you really get into their thoughts? Is it hard for you then to step away from the desk and be you again?
No, actually, because I don't know why it isn't, but because I spent so much time with them, years with them. Some of it is that I wrote it in such a layering way that the layers just appeared over the course of years and changed around, and I do feel like I know them pretty well, but I guess maybe they're enough part of me and the way that I think that I didn't feel a break.
9 years. Do you miss them?
I miss some of the characters I didn't get to develop as much as I would have liked to. Sister Tudor is one. I just love Sister Tudor. That name came from looking at English nursing texts. Just a magical name. And so I found a way to fit that in. I actually wrote around trying to get her in. And when I visited the hospital, and I knew that it was a very Protestant country, and there weren't a lot of nuns in Finland, but I was shown some of the private photo albums of a former head nurse, the first head nurse at the hospital, actually. And there was a picture of two nurses flanking this little nun, this little tiny nun.
Miley Chapman talking to Hadley Freeman. Now, I can reveal that it was the overall favourite of the Waterstones reading groups who took part in the judging process of this year's first book award. The final shortlisted author, Catherine Schultz, will be talking to us next week in advance of the award ceremony on December the 1st. Now, you may have noticed that Sarah Crown has been absent from the podcast for the last few weeks. She's been a bit poorly, but the good news is that she's back and she's grinning like a Cheshire cat on the other side of the studio. But we thought we'd break her in gently by asking her to tell us everything that's coming up in The Guardian and The Observer over the next week. Welcome back, Sarah.
Thank you.
But first, just tell us how anybody's going to be able to win those two very covetable Patti Smith memoirs.
Yes, yes. We have these two signed copies of Patti Smith's award-winning memoir, Just Kids, to give away. And if you're interested in winning one of them, details of how to enter are on the front of this podcast. And if you've come to us through iTunes, you'll find it on guardian.co.uk/books. And we also have two winners of our first book award quiz launched on the podcast and in Guardian Review 3 weeks ago. And they are Abigail Crook and Amy Wood. So congratulations to both of you, and your sets of the shortlisted books are in the post.
And what about the stuff that's coming up then?
Okay, over the next few days, we've got in the Guardian Review on Saturday, James Meek, later this parish, goes to Tolstoy's estate on the centenary of his death, while David Hare rushes to the defence of actors, Angelina Jolie in particular, I think. In The Observer on Sunday, James Purdon reviews Lloyd Jones's Hand Me Down World, which, as you will probably remember, was the subject of the very first Guardian Books Twitter group.
And you can actually find that on #HMDWChat. And it was a great chat. It unrolled beautifully
really
over the 2 or 3 weeks. Thanks very much, Sarah. We'll expect you to do more next week. And that's all from us this week. Do join us again next week. Until then, thanks for listening. I'm Claire Armistead, and our producer is Tim Mabey.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.
Don't forget to start your free 14-day trial of audible.co.uk and to download your free audiobook, head to guardian.co.uk/audible.